everyone, and welcome to episode 11 of the Well and Wild podcast. I hope you've all had a great week. Today, we've got a really exciting guest on. His name is Tom Pope, and he is an endurance athlete as well as a corporate executive headhunter in the city. So Tom is always traveling the world doing Ironman races, ultra marathons, and just crazy things like that. I got him on because he is someone who has a conventional job. So I know that's a little bit different to some of the people that I've got on here in terms of they just gave it all up and went and pursued their passion. But Tom has kind of identified that he's got this passion for endurance sports, but he's decided that he enjoys his corporate career as well, and he's managed to balance the two. So I thought that getting him on here would be really interesting for him to provide his kind of perspective on how he balances the two, and also just understand how being able to do the thing that he loves, as in the endurance stuff, actually benefits his work and his overall career. So it's a really interesting conversation, and Tom has a lot of inspirational kind of wisdom that he shares on this episode. So I hope that you enjoy it, and thank you so much for listening. Tom, welcome, and thank you so much for coming on my podcast. I appreciate it. I know you've travelled far to be here today.
long way.
All the way from downstairs.
Yeah. Two flights of stairs.
Yeah, for the listeners, Tom is actually my neighbour, so roped him into this. But it would be great if you could start by telling the listeners a little bit more about yourself. So we're obviously going to dive into everything later on, but just an initial intro would be great.
Okay. So I've run 43 marathon distances. I've covered three Ironman. I've competed for my country as a good for age duathlete. And I've done all of that by kind of following my own path in terms of the job that I have gone on to do and the sort of lifestyle that I half created for myself, by probably not following the traditional route of what a graduate should go and do.
Yeah, I think that's really cool, and I just had no idea, and you just come out with all of that and you've just lived downstairs.
Well, I think it's probably Instagram's a good way of seeing what your neighbours do.
It's just funny, it's like so true that you don't sort of like speak to your neighbours anymore, and you don't really know anything about who lives next door.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite rare to be sat in your neighbour's kitchen,
having a cup of tea,
you know. Yeah, the two microphones.
Very true. Okay, so obviously we chatted before, and your background growing up before you moved to London, it would be good to talk a little bit about that. So you went to state school, right?
I went to a grammar school in Folkestone, which is southeast England in Kent. It's not a great place, to be honest with you. It's a nice school, but it's not a great place. It's probably even worse now. But I've got a great number of mates and family down there. That's where I grew up, and you eventually go to university, don't you? And then you did a bit of traveling.
What did you do at uni?
I actually started. I wanted to be a graphic designer, believe it or not, and I did a small course in it, and I thought that by the time I got to 30, if I stayed doing that as a 20-year-old, then I wouldn't have the kind of opportunity that I've been able to generate for myself. So I sort of turned my back on it, because I thought it was more of a vocation than a career per se. So I started doing that, and then I thought, I looked at it and think, well, it's more of a hobby for me. I was quite good at it, but I didn't want to follow that. I wanted to go and do, you know, other things. And then I ended up went to Birmingham University and did a history degree, believe it or not, because I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And history just opens up, you know, a number of avenues. It was a good uni. I was relatively decent at writing essays and working out what to say and how to get good marks. So I spent 3 years there, in between a year in Australia.
Cool.
Yeah, and then landed in London. After that, I've been here for like 10 years now. It's mad.
Wow.
Maybe, 10 years, I don't know.
Yeah, time just goes, I feel like, in London.
And then 2 years ago, I bought the flat downstairs. So,
Nice. So let's talk a bit about that then. So you moved to London, got a job, presumably. So what job did you get, and what was your experience? So
it was quite an interesting one, actually, because I was at a house party at university.
Okay.
And my girlfriend at the time, her housemate was dating my current boss.
Okay.
Okay, so that's a long story. What ended up happening is we were on the barbecue and the girls were watching maybe it was Strictly Come Dancing. Okay. Or some kind Pop Idol or something like that.
Pop Idol, that was
a long
time
ago. Pop Idol was probably, yeah. Like is that 10 years ago?
Probably.
So they were watching that inside and I got talking to this chap and he worked in a business in Mayfair and it was a sort of lucrative sales job.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got to finishing uni, I was ready just to kind of get out of that atmosphere and go and I wanted to go mm-hmm. and do something constructive. I wanted to go and apply myself and go after things, mm-hmm. and do things, achieve stuff. And I sort of recognised that you need, a certain income to be able to do the things I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So the chap that I know, Christian, just said, why don't you come down and interview for this firm? And I did, and they offered me the job on the day.
Nice.
Yeah, and they also at the time offered me a place to live in Islington.
Oh my God.
Rent free for the summer.
What? That never happens.
Yeah, it's quite good. And then about 3 weeks after starting, I was taken to Ibiza for free.
Wow. Yeah. What kind of company so is
it was,
this?
It was a recruitment business that that had done very well for itself. The owners had sold a previous company and set a new one up. And they had an office in Bond Street, and it was, when you come out of university and you grew up in Kent and you went to Birmingham and then you're working in Bond Street for the mm. first time around, some very successful people, it has a certain knock-on impact,
I know what you mean.
So yeah, but it was all privately owned. It's always been privately owned, but there's no real, HR policies or,
yeah.
it's quite rogue, in that sense. But there was everything was driven by a strong work ethic, and kind of drive to succeed, which from the moment I sort of set foot in an office was what I've kind of seen and been conditioned by. So I loved it in that sense, yeah.
Okay, so it's fair to say then that you did enjoy it rather than...
I enjoyed that job. I mean, I've had jobs I haven't enjoyed.
So maybe let's move on to one where you realised that you didn't particularly like it. And what was your experience there?
Yes, I mean, I've had jobs just trying to create some cash, when I was a lot younger.
Okay.
There's a power station in the southeast called Dungeness.
Okay.
Which is awful. So there was a job there that I had for the summer where they've got a visitor centre and in between the visitor centre where you can go and see this, apparently this wildlife, that exists in the area. They had a load of paving slabs. My job in the summer was to scrape the moss out between the paving slabs with a knife.
Okay, with a knife?
Yeah, because you're not allowed to spray the weeds because of this. You kill this butterfly, apparently. I didn't enjoy that at all. I did a lot of work in Australia that was, fruit picking and other bits and pieces like that. And I did some internships in some advertising agencies.
Okay.
Unpaid internships between graduating and getting this job.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always sort of thought, well, if you don't enjoy it, don't do it.
Yeah.
I've always thought that because, life's sort of too short. And if you're going to do it correctly, get something out of it and mm-hmm. use it and learn from it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, don't bother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And I think it's really interesting about your story because I've had a lot of people on here whose story is that they started out in corporate life, realised they didn't really enjoy it, and then quit and did something completely different, whether that's sport or building a business. But yours is really interesting because you didn't necessarily not like it in the corporate world and you're still in kind of the corporate world.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, then you have this massive hobby on the side.
So what I'd say about my job, in the sense that, yes, it's in the corporate world per se, as it's in an office, but it's always been in a very small, easily managed office with a group mm-hmm. of like-minded people. So, as I said, the corporate route for me as a graduate would have been go into PwC or go into Accenture or go into KPMG, which is a lot of my colleagues did. But I immediately sort of knew that I didn't want to do that because I didn't want anyone telling me that, you know, in 18 months your salary could be this, you know, and in 24 months you're going to be doing this. And I just wasn't excited.
How did you recognise that though? Because I think that's really hard to recognise when you're quite young.
Yes, a very good question. I think, so I had some personal experiences in my family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that move my mindset on somewhat, I think. So my mum, and this is why I started doing this, I'm sure we'll come on to this, but my mum was beginning to get quite ill as I was exiting uni and thinking about what to do with myself. So I never felt like I needed the comfort blanket of what everyone else did.
Mm.
I never felt, you know, well, just because such and such is doing that, you know, and there's 70% of people in my course going into that, then I should go and do that. You know, there's a lot of people went into teaching and a lot of people went on to do sort of further, you know, degrees and masters and so on, you know, and then everyone else kind of just gets swept into consultancy and, roles that do they enjoy them? Do they not? You know, do you just want to come to London? So I kind of did all of that, but I wanted to do it on my terms.
Okay.
And my terms were, you know, I want to drive a certain income level and I want to apply myself, work towards a target, hit that target, grow, move, you know, do things.
Mm.
Rather than almost just be part of a mass group of people just for the sake of it. You know, I can't stand numbers. I can't stand tax. I can't stand audit. I can't stand these things. They've just never interested me. I never thought I had to conform. I'm not saying that people in finance and tax conform, but I'm just saying maybe they have a bit more of a obedience towards a certain structure than I ever had. You know, you can be successful in a number of things. You can be very, very successful in it, but it just wasn't something I had an interest in, really.
Yeah, I think that's really lucky, though, because a lot of people get swept up into doing those things and before you know it, you're stuck because you enjoy the bonus you get every year, you enjoy the title, like it's easy to stay in the job sometimes because you've built up such a network.
Yeah.
But I think that's really good that you recognise that so early on.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's just a human being, you know, it's like whether you're a director in this or a VP in that and your firm turns over this and that, or, you know, you work in a particular sector that's got a certain, I don't know, reputation about it or kudos, you know, it's still, you are just a person.
Yeah.
You know, I think people can get swept away by the importance of, you know, what other people might choose to associate with that industry. And I don't know, it's just the way I was brought up. It just didn't bother me at all.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. Yeah. And so your current job then, is that the same one as you were talking about?
No, so I've been through two or three similar types of companies since, but yeah, I'm now back. So I'm the director now of a privately owned search firm.
Mm-hmm.
It does a lot of work for all of our work outside of the UK into Switzerland and Germany and the Netherlands and the US and Asia and so on. So travel around quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I've sort of managed to land on my feet in an environment where I know the two guys that run it, you know, like mates, you know, which is a great thing for me. I get cut a lot of slack, you know, and they trust me, and I trust them, you know, and we're all trying now to build our own business together. And it's pretty rewarding.
I really like the story of how you got that job, actually, because weren't the owners of it like mates of yours or contacts already? I think that was.
Yeah, so I used to work, Christian, who's the chap that I met at my ex-girlfriend's barbecue.
Okay.
Got me the job at the first company.
Yeah.
And then I sort of got to the top in that first company quite quickly, and then Christian went off and set up his own business with a chap called Grant, who I also work with now. I went off and did something else for 3-4 years in the city. It was a bit more stuffy and corporate, that job. And then we now then all work together at the back end of it. So that meeting, you know, in that barbecue, when all the girls were watching
Pop Idol,
whatever it was, dancing on Pop or whatever, where, you know, that's sort of carved out my professional framework, I guess, for the last decade or so.
I think that's a really important message as well, and I do thank my finance job for teaching me the power of networking, because they used to drill it into us that we needed to network with our peers. And I think that was so important, because all of us that were on the graduate scheme at the time, in what, 5-10 years, we're probably hardly any of us are going to be left there. They'd be at different funds or whatever, like different companies, who could turn out to be clients, could turn out to be employers. And that's just like finance, but for anything, the power of networking, you never know who someone is or like where they might go, where they might end up.
So, and, you know, especially if you're working for a smaller business that doesn't have a big reputation, you know, then you have to sort of self-market and advertise yourself and your service, you know, then the way to do that is 100% networking. You know, if you don't have a brand behind you, people can't just quickly associate, you know, so JP Morgan, bang, you know, people know where that sits. Accenture, bang, people know where that sits. If you work for a privately owned company that's in startup mode, you know, your strength is the people that you liaise with and the people that you contact and the people that you're building that relationship through. And that, I've always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to work for a smaller company where I was, you know, not just a part of the machine. I was actually doing something constructive with it. That was, I don't know where that came from.
Yeah. So before we go on to the cool stuff of the endurance, it would be good to just pick out, because you're obviously, you like your current job.
Yeah.
So what do you think it is about that job that makes you like it? Because you've obviously recognised that some of the corporate jobs aren't for you. So it would be good, some of the listeners listening might not necessarily like their job, but they might not necessarily want to have their own business either. So it's useful to provide a perspective of what kind of companies you can find in the middle, if you know what I mean.
So I always, you know, working as a search consultant or a sort of, you know, recruiter, if you will, I always encourage people to make a decision on who they're going to work for. So the person, irrespective of what the company does, irrespective of, you know, what that company's reputation might be, is that your job's going to be defined in and around you by the 4 or 5 people that sit, you know, either on your desk or that you report to. So the first thing you've got to absolutely get right, in my opinion, is do you like the person that you're sitting in front of?
Yeah, that's so true.
Because a lot of people take jobs because they think they need to, because they think that that brand looks great on their resume, or, you know, I'll get more work if I go off and do that. And they might not actually see eye to eye with the person that they're going to report into or those that sit in their team. And then you just, you become slightly alienated. So I'd always make a call on the person as opposed to the company. So for instance, you know, if you're going to come out of university and you say, well, I need to go and work for JP Morgan. Well, you might not actually, you know, you might need to go on and work for someone that's going to trust in you, empower you, give you more responsibility, help you grow quicker and get you ahead of the curve, you know, versus someone that's going to do the same thing but be, you know, miles and miles down the chain. That would be, I guess that would be my major part.
That's really interesting, actually. And I thought back to some interviews that I've had for companies, and what would be your advice to someone who's only met like 1 or 2 people through the interview process and then they get an offer but they just don't feel like... Can you ask to meet other people?
Absolutely.
How would you go about that?
Definitely.
I know that's a bit of a recruiter question.
No, but you know, ultimately, so you've got to feel comfortable, right? And if you smell a rat, or if you think they're too keen, or if you're not trusting in the process, if you want to go and, you know, spend some time with them, and the company wants to hire you, they will allow you that privilege. You know, so working at a certain level, you'll fly people into, you know, a different continent so they can meet 1 or 2 characters, you know, just to make sure that they see eye to eye with that person. And again, at a certain level, you know, once someone's worked out that you're good for that job, you know, you're not talking about the job. You're no longer talking about, you know, the job. You're talking about interests, family, you know, you're talking about objectives, you know, backgrounds, education, skills. You're not actually saying, it's not an interview anymore.
Like a personality fit instead.
So I'd always also ask yourself, you know, this is really difficult. It's really difficult. But where do you see yourself in 10 years' time? 5 years' time even? Because, you know, personally, I made the choice to say, if I was going to go down the corporate route, or if I was going to go down the graphic design route, then I already knew on the graphic design route that by 30, I wouldn't be able to afford a flat and buy my own flat and do other bits and pieces. And if I went into corporate, you know, I already knew that I didn't want to be kind of pocketed into a salary banding in an industry that I didn't really have much connection with.
So
try and think, you know, 1, 2, 3 moves time and think, you know, how is that going to get me to where I want to go? But not everyone does that.
Yeah, I agree. Some people are a bit scared of doing that as well, I think. But you don't need to have all the answers. And it can change.
Of course, yeah.
But I think it is important to think about. Okay, let's move on to some of the endurance stuff that you're doing. So you obviously have this passion for this endurance sports. How did that start? Where did it come from?
So I used to play a lot of football at school. A lot of football. Wasn't much good in it. I just used to play a lot of it.
Yeah.
When I got to university, you play occasionally. And then when you come to London, to actually play at the weekends is very difficult, you know, because you work pretty hard and then you've got to get across town and, you know, you might not know too many people. And the first job I took was, I trusted myself to try and make something of it, but was paid an absolute pittance. You know, it was in Mayfair, but I wasn't earning any money whatsoever.
But they took you to Ibiza.
Yeah, so, you know, swings and roundabouts and a free accommodation for the summer.
Yeah.
So, what ended up happening was, so at the same time as I took a new job and left university, my mum started to deteriorate.
Mm.
So she was diagnosed with a condition that's quite linked to multiple sclerosis.
Okay.
And whilst I was kind of working my nuts off without any means, you know, to enjoy myself with, I was living with a banker and a kind of full-time gambler who was a trader. So they had an extortionate amount of expendable income to be able to, you know, to go out with. And I could just about afford rent and my phone bill and my travel. That was it. So I had a bit of free time. Mum was getting ill and I was in a bit of a kind of bad place. So I thought, I need to take charge of this. So I wrote to a marathon charity, a charity called MSRC.
Okay.
Didn't think anything of it. I didn't think I'd get a spot. You know, I thought everyone wants to run a marathon. This isn't gonna fly. And they wrote back to me on the day and were like, look, you know, we want you on the team, you know. And I thought, hang on a minute, what's this all about? And I kind of told them a bit about my story and whatnot. And started training for the marathon. Ended up doing laps of the Isle of Dogs, you know, in the evening. It's not the best place to train for a marathon in Canary Wharf where I was living. It's not good. And then, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. You know, friends of mine had run it, and most of friends' dads had run it. Actually, you know,
had you ever done anything like that?
I hated running.
Okay.
At school, I hated it. It was just a means of get from, you know, move the ball from one to the other, and then run after it, tackle, play. You know, so running was just a means to an end, and it was, you know, I didn't think anything of it. My style was awful. I wasn't that quick, but in the marathon. In the first ever marathon, something just happens to you.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing it for a reason that you're connected to, which was the charity. And, you know, I raised about $5,000, which I was amazed by, you know, people's generosity.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And I came in about 6 minutes quicker than I thought I would. And I actually got quicker as I went. And I thought, hang on a minute, you know, I reckon I could do this quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as I finished, I signed up again.
Mm-hmm.
And by the back end of the first year, I'd run 4 marathons.
Oh my God.
It raised about £17,000.
That's amazing.
And that was it. I was hooked.
Yeah.
So that was year one.
That's so good. I think, like, that's amazing. What do you think changed where you decided that you loved running versus, like, being at school and hating it? Like, what changed?
It's control.
Okay.
It's control and it's the feeling that you're making a difference when there's something that you need to make a difference for, you know. So when my mum's getting worse and worse, and then she's medically retired, and then she's in a care home, you know, she went from having a walking stick to a frame, to a wheelchair, to a, you know, to being medically retired, to a care home, to having a living carer rather, and then, you know, ultimately passing away on her 60th birthday, or in and around her 60th birthday. I found that the sort of the more she deteriorated, the more I upped my game to kind of compensate for, you know, her inability to move, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of mental stuff happening there. There's a lot of mental health things that you're also trying to cover off, and there's a great deal of satisfaction that you're giving the family, and that you're creating a massive amount of positivity every time you step out and run.
Yeah.
And people are writing you messages and sponsoring you, you know. And I think I have lost a bit of track, but I think between myself and all my friends that I've roped in over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years to get involved with this charity, we've raised north of about 50 grand.
That's insane. So good.
Every time you commit to that, you know, the motivation of, well, if I run this, I'm going to earn that.
Yeah.
My mum will smile, and, you know, my family will be more proud of me. And
yeah.
And then the knock-on impact of the benefits that you get from the endorphins and the exercise, how that just makes you see the world. You know, nothing's difficult or as difficult after you've done a marathon.
Mm.
It might sound corny.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah. And then do three, then do four, then do five. And then all of a sudden you've done 7 or 8. And then, you know, something like going out and choosing the job that you want to do, or walking into a social situation, you've just got a frame of reference.
Mm.
You know, that's easier. So, because that's harder.
Mm.
And I've just kind of seized things up like that. It's weird.
I think that's amazing. I think that it just goes to show how important it is to come up with like why you're doing something and really connect to the mission of that. Because I guess for you, that was kind of a coping mechanism, but then also a way for you to kind of like make your mum feel a bit of happiness from what you're doing, if you know what I mean. And I think that was such a strong motivator in your head, and that's why you enjoyed it, and that's why you got addicted to it. And you can kind of relate that to anything, like a business mission or what you want to do in your own life.
It just
changes completely how your enjoyment of something.
It's definitely true. So you're going to be a lot more effective at something if you want to do it. So again, translate that back to the job. You know, do you want to go and work for a bank, or do you want to go and work for a consultancy? If you do, then you're going to be good at it. You know, if you don't, then you're going to find yourself 24 months down the line going, you know, this isn't what. But the other thing that I think you can do is you can balance the two out. So I think you can tolerate something that you don't like, you know, as a means to an end, if you've got on the side something that you've got a passion for. You know, always thought that. So if your passion is not your work, make your work something that finances what your passion is. So you've got to have a passion in your job or outside of the job to give you a focus. Because if you don't have one or the other, you just, you know, it's only me talking, but I think you're more likely to drift and lose track, you know, drop in and out, you know, and maybe, I don't know, take your eye off the ball, I guess. So.
And I also, just on the point as well, I think that's amazing that in a tough situation you decided to do something really positive to have an impact on everybody else, because you could have easily like really struggled with that and let that consume you. And so I think that's really like impressive.
Thanks. I always thought that, you know, if something's going badly, you know, either look it in the face and say, okay, so it's going badly, but I need to sort it out and I need to create a reaction to it, and don't let it define you. If you're going to let it define you, let it define you positively, and let it sort of almost turn it on its head and transmit a message out of it and go, okay, cool, so mum's not very well, everyone knows this, but you know what, I'm going to do something about it. And you have a selfish motivation because you know you're getting fitter, and you have a personal interest in the times that you're running, you know, and you want to go and see the world and run places. But, you know, at the same time, at the back of your head, there's always, you know, why did it in the first place, where it comes from, and what you were trying to repair, maybe.
And I think on this point, it might be worth just saying, if anyone's listening and they're going through some shit situation, what would be your advice, like from your experience, at that point where you can decide to go one way or the other?
That's a really good question. My choice obviously was sort of the pursuit of targets and, you know, fitness and, you know, using, I guess, accomplishments and exercise to overturn what could be a pretty dark spot.
Yeah.
I think what people can do, it took me ages to do this. Yes, it's a bit of a miracle that I'm sat in front of you talking like this, honestly, because people, don't talk about stuff as much as they could. I find it, if you're in a bad spot, you know, whether or it's, you know, if it's mental health or if it's, you know, something to do with yourself or something to do with a friend or a family member or whatever, unless you get it out in the open, unless you sort of acknowledge it, then you're going to let it define you.
Yeah.
Because you just store things up and you store things up, and it doesn't have to manifest itself in running marathons and doing Ironman triathlon.
Run across the desert. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah. I just found something that worked for me. It's that will run out.
Yeah.
You know, I had a steroid injection today in my knee, you know, yeah. like that. So my knee, you know, so I can't do it forever, but it enabled me to kind of, you know, put myself in a situation where people knew why I was doing it. So people would ask me about it. And in that way, I was kind of addressing people to say, can you help me? You know?
Yeah, okay, I see. Yeah. Like in a kind of indirect way.
Yeah. Because I was a bit uncomfortable to go, can I have a chat with you?
Yeah, that's, you know, like a really interesting point. I didn't think about it like that.
Like the week, I couldn't tell people, at the weekend I've had with mum, you know,
yeah.
this incident happened and I was told this, and, you know, and the latest occurrence in her illness is this, and we've been told she's got this long to live and blah, blah, blah. I found that really difficult. But what I found easy was, you know, sort of pushing myself. Oh, it's almost like punishing yourself, really. Yeah. It is, you know, it's really odd. But it gave me a platform for people to notice me.
Okay.
So what I would say is, you don't have to do that, but you can talk about it. And you can talk about it, and maybe you'll save your knees. Because, you know, I've done a few of these things now. But we are living in society now where it's becoming, you know, a lot more acceptable to talk about problems. You know?
And I think people do struggle, but I think you've just made a really good point that it doesn't need to be in the like medium of telling someone directly. There's different ways of doing it if you don't feel necessarily comfortable. So I think that's good to kind of highlight.
If you can't speak, you know, then I always thought, distract yourself, throw yourself into something.
Yeah.
You know, take your mind to a different spot. So if it's sport, or if it's, I don't know, if it's art, or if it's you want to, you know, disappear and do some traveling or something. Yeah. Just work out, you know, that you're a human being, you need a break. You've got to be able to breathe in your head.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a bit more. So you found these marathons, you really enjoyed them, and then you kind of took it to new limits. So you told me about this desert one. So let's talk about that. Tell everyone about that, because it's just crazy.
So one thing led to another, and by the back end of year one, I'd run 4 marathons. By the back end of year two, I'd maybe run 10, maybe, I don't know. But in the midpoint of that second year, my flatmate at the time was starting to get into cycling.
Okay.
And he was cycling from Paris to London. You know, I didn't really have a bike. I just bought a bike then the weekend before, and I was like, well, I'll come with you. I didn't know the first thing about riding a bike. to that extent, you know, and again, just really enjoyed it. Loved the challenge, loved the distraction of it. You know, again, there was a charity element to it. So, you know.
How long does that take? I wouldn't even.
Paris to London, I think you can do it in 2 days. In fact, you can do it in 1 day if you really go for it. We did it in 3, I think.
Okay.
Something like that, maybe 3.5.
Cool.
So that was quite cool. It was a little adventure.
Yeah.
But what ended up happening is sort of, you know, I did the marathons and all of a sudden I could ride a bike. So I was like, okay, well, I'll go out to, you know, parts of Europe, and I'll cycle my bike over these, you know, big alpine passes and so on. And then you kind of land, you go, well, if I can cycle, if I can run, maybe I'll do a triathlon, you know. And then all of a sudden
I can pick swimming up.
I'm not very good at swimming. And all of a sudden I did a half Ironman triathlon. That was the first triathlon I ever did, you know.
Can you explain what Ironman is as well?
It's an Ironman.
I knew it was something extreme, but didn't really know exactly
The Ironman is a 2.4 mile swim, and then a 180k bike ride, and then a marathon at the back end of it.
Oh my god!
In one go, right? Okay. So they have double and triple Ironmans, which I wouldn't do. I just, it's madness. But
I feel like you would do that.
I think, do you know what? I think a couple of years ago I might have done.
Okay.
You know, but I'm beginning to, calm down slightly.
Okay.
But you do that. But the half distance is basically all those things halved, and I, yeah. In a long, a long way round of saying this. I did the half Ironman. Then all of a sudden I was like, well, I've done it half. I'll probably do the full. Then I did the full one.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did the second full one in about 3 months later.
Oh my God.
That was in, I did Nice and I did it in Tenby. But my mum passed away as I was in the Nice Ironman, which was really, really difficult.
I can imagine.
So going through all of that exhaustion, you know, physically and mentally, and then meeting my dad at the end, who told me, you've got to get on a plane
really
and go home.
Right in the middle.
So, but then by the time I got out of the Ironman, and I did another one actually the year after, I kind of was a little bit like, what am I going to do now? And with mum's passing, I'd always heard about this thing called the Marathon des Sables. Which is the thing you're talking about.
Yeah, right? The desert.
So that's a self-supported series of marathons across the Sahara Desert. So they drop you in the at the start, and you just got all your gear and your food. That's it. The only thing you get is water and shelter overnight. And then they give you a map and they say, crack on. So you don't have to use the map because you follow the people in front.
But are there always people around you? Not necessarily.
Well, I mean, there are at certain parts in the race, but if you're, if you're towards the top end of it, there aren't many people around. And then one day it gets very dark, and you're marching around sand dunes in the pitch black with a little torch on you. But it's I think it was 180 miles, 250k maybe, 260k over the week. And it's like a marathon every day, where you wake up and then you carry your gear. Now, I eat a lot, so I was carrying about 10, 11 kilos every day on my back in, 45, 55 degree heat.
Yeah, I was going to say it must have been absolutely boiling.
It was hot, but I was fortunate enough to be fit enough to finish before the sun really, really hit its peak,
Right.
So there's about 1,300 runners, and I finished 78th.
That's amazing.
And I was the 15th Brit over the line, which I was pretty chuffed about, considering my pack weighed so much. So I was going to get him back before the sun was burning people.
That's such a good point, because the people that aren't quite as strong runners, they've got it even more even more tough, because they've got to run through that.
There's a lad in my tent that had never run a marathon before.
Oh my God, why would you?
So you think I'm mad? I was half conditioned to do it.
Did he finish it?
Yeah.
Oh, good on him.
But there were, on the first day, I think 200 people drop out.
Wow, okay.
And then throughout the week, more and more people disappear.
Mm.
And on day four, you have to run two marathons. You have to run a marathon into another one.
Oh
my
God.
It was like a 55 mile day or something.
But what was that whole experience like? Like, that must have got really difficult, challenging. just how did it feel? Like, what was it? What was the experience like? Painful.
It was amazing. Honestly, I mean, the pain was tough on your joints and on your feet, on your back and stuff. That hurts, and you sleep on the Sahara floor. Just have a ground sheet, and the Sahara floor is like rocky, and it's not like a sort of sandcastle. It's just like rocky. It's everything everywhere. There's wind storms that batter the tent at night. It's freezing in the night. The sleeping bag that you have is one that you carry on your back, and it's tucked into a small ball, and then you don't have a pillow because you can't carry a pillow, so you have like an inflatable thing, and you just sleep on your clothes. You get about 3.5 hours kip a night. You eat a tent meal that you had to carry, and you heat it up on a stove that you've had to carry as well, so you're undernourished, you don't sleep, and you get up in the morning
in
the desert
torture.
Without a shower, and you just go, and you go in the same clothes the day before that you slept in. So you absolutely hum.
Yeah.
You can crack your clothes, and
but you don't care about that at that time, surely.
But I loved it.
Yeah. A cool experience, though. Incredible.
It was excellent. You meet six or seven other people in the tent. It's a group of eight lads that didn't know each other. I'd met one or two of them before, actually. And then we got there, and we had a medic knock on our tent door and was like, "Can any of you guys, have you got a spare bed? Have you got a spare slot in the tent? Are you a medic?" "Yes, I am." "Immediately get yourself in here, mate," because he was sorting
everyone's
problems out. But yeah, the whole experience of it was fantastic, and it was after Mum had passed. So I was able to take a lot of comfort from all the messages that were being sent to me when I was out there.
You know?
And again, we had a 10 grand fundraising target, which despite all the fundraising before, we flew through, absolutely flew
amazing.
Through. Did a number of silly things to get to that point, mind you.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like what?
I ran a marathon in a mankini.
Oh my God. Oh my God, that's so
Milton
funny.
Keynes, yeah, Milton Keynes Marathon. The week after London Marathon, I ran the Milton Keynes Marathon in a mankini.
That is hilarious. Do you think it helped with the speed or?
Yeah, because you want to get out quicker.
Okay, so, yeah. Yeah, true.
So some chap said to me, he goes, fair play, mate. He said, you got a lot of balls. I said, oh, cheers.
Oh my
he said,
God.
Yeah, I can see him.
Oh my God. That's so funny. But fair enough if you raised a ton of money.
Yeah, yeah. So we raised, you know, that day, a friend of mine actually challenged me and said, you know, actually I put the thing out on Facebook. I said, I'm running two marathons in a week. To stay in shape for this marathon to Saab, I'm going to run at Milton Keynes. Anyone got any ideas, you know, how I can generate some money and sponsorship? Straight away, run in a mankini. I went, okay, all right, so how much are you going to pay me? And then I just got a series of pledges come in. And then I did it. I don't think anyone believed I actually was going to do it.
Oh my God. So people went for it then?
Yeah. And then I was on Milton Keynes News and being interviewed by the BBC. And
amazing.
I had to quickly get my clothes back
on. That's so funny. So if anyone listening then wanted to get into like these ultra endurance events, what would you suggest they start with and how can they get
it's
involved?
A very, very, very good question. Because I think that the tendency is for someone to go, I'm going to run a marathon.
Right.
You go, okay, cool. So, what's your background in anything, you know, sporting or anything, you know, muscular or endurance focused, you know, and a lot of people say, well, nothing. You go, okay, well, so probably don't go, I'm going to run a marathon, you know. The smart way to do it is go, well, I'm going to run a 10K, then I'm going to run a half marathon, then I'm going to run a full marathon. I'm going to see actually if I enjoy it. Because what tends to happen is that, you know, a first time runner that wants to do the marathon commits to a distance that they don't know about.
Yeah.
They're putting their body through something that is really very stressful.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, quite a large proportion of people get injured when they first do it.
Okay.
So if you've never really run before, you know, put it into a manageable chunk and say, look, I'm going to give a few events this year ago, and next year I might take the marathon on. And a little bit like your job, you know, the London Marathon isn't the zenith of all marathons, you know, just like the audit house isn't the zenith of all corporate jobs, you know, or successful jobs. There are marathons everywhere, absolutely everywhere. I mean, I'm doing two in Switzerland next month.
Nice.
But I'm doing them so I can also go and see the mountains. I'm going to see the Matterhorn and then go back and see the Eiger, you know, two weeks apart.
That's kind of what I wanted to bring it back to, actually. So, because when we spoke before, you explained that, like, your job enables you to just now go around the world and go and see the world and do all these events as well.
Yeah.
So can you talk a bit about that? Because I think that's really good way of looking at it.
Yeah, so again, you know, think of the situation that you're in and how you can maximize it, and how you can, you know, sort of combine your job and your passion simultaneously. And we've got a lot of clients in Switzerland, so if I'm ever out in Switzerland, you know, I'll also have a quick Google and I'll maybe find out that there's a marathon or a big cycle ride or something.
As
you know,
you do.
And I'll drop a note to a client and say, look, you know, can we meet? Can we talk about what you've got coming up? And maybe I'll stay over at the weekend and go and, you know, climb the mountain or run, you know, run around the foot of a lake or something. You know, that's how you can do that. So, as I said, I'm pretty fortunate to be in that situation. But just think about it.
Yeah.
You know, someone's going to finance your flight to that part of the world for you to go and meet someone on their behalf. You know, stay over at the weekend. And work out the date that works for you. You know, not necessarily for the person you work for all the time, but one that works for you, and manipulate the situation to your advantage.
And final point on that as well, if people out there have like a hobby or a passion that, like, for sport or something that they really wanted to do, but they're just that's really important to them, but they just feel like their manager might not be supportive or anything like that, how would you suggest starting that conversation? Or, like, what do you think is from your experience, what's important for the manager to be supportive of?
So I've been through a lot of this actually recently at work. So we have we've got a tool now in place where, because we employ, you know, quite a high proportion of millennials or generation wise, yeah. So, you know, whatever the term is. A lot of work now actually and mentality is around the individual, and it's around, you know, is this job right for me? And I want this from you, rather than the employer wanting something from someone else. There's a big shift I see in younger people coming into work that have expectations that I didn't have 10 years ago, and that my dad certainly didn't have, my mum certainly didn't have. So we've had to get quite adept at kind of processing these requests. Mm-hmm. So I think nowadays, you know, if you're in your mid-20s, early 20s, it's actually expected now to be able to say, you know, how does my job fulfill me in the following ways, you know?
Yeah.
Mentally, you know, socially, I don't know, from a physical perspective, health and fitness, how am I getting these things? And I think you're well within your rights now to actually go and ask.
Okay.
But again, you know, it's actually about who you work for. If you don't see eye to eye with someone that doesn't understand what makes you tick,
yeah.
If you don't tick, you're not going to get a result. If you don't get a result, you're not going to perform, you're not going to excel. So, you know, it's in your manager's interest to understand who you are, let you be the best version of that possible, so you can take that into work. You're not going to leave. If someone says to you, okay, do you know what? Take the Friday off, go and do what you need to do, you know, if you're training for something or if you need to go somewhere else, you know, and the flexibility that you'll give to someone should play itself back positively.
Yeah.
And I think people totally are probably scared to push that boundary in case they go, well, they're not going to let me have it. And if they don't let me have it, they think I'm not committed I'm actually going to upset them. Mm. I think it's, you know, you just got to be a bit ballsy to find that line.
If you don't ask, you don't get. And really, how likely is it that they're just going to fire you on the spot for asking? Well,
exactly.
Like,
you know, what's the worst they can do?
Yeah.
You know?
And arguably, with you being able to do all these events and everything that you love, I'm sure it's like affected your performance at work positively.
But that's the other thing. Find someone that understands that. Because if you're in a result driven environment, you know, and people are giving you, cutting you slack and trusting you, and in response, you're generating better results than you would have before, you know, again, it's self-serving.
Yeah.
It's absolutely self-serving. So if you want to do something like that and your manager doesn't see eye to eye, you know, I'd probably explain how you might make the time back, or I'd explain, you know, maybe a goal or an objective that you're going to work towards, how you're going to stretch yourself in return, and show the person, you know, look, if you let me have this, I'm going to give you that.
Yeah, that's
break
a really
it down.
Good
so
point.
Risk reward.
Yeah.
You know? Because you can't just go in and say, I want Friday off. Why?
Because they just think
the Spice Girls
up.
Are,
yeah.
You know, okay, well, great. You know, but what's that going to do for me?
Yeah.
You know, people need to give each other something.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Okay, we're kind of coming up to the end, but I have a quick fire round.
All right.
If that's all right. So cool. It's three questions. First one, what's the best book that you've ever read?
Oh, great question. There's a couple. So I was in Mauritius earlier in the year.
Nice.
And I read a book called Shoe Dog.
Yeah, we were chatting about that one, yeah.
So Shoe Dog is absolutely phenomenal. It's Phil Knight's autobiography. He's the chap that started Nike.
Yeah.
And what comes through is that, you know, although he's worth God knows how many billion, he's like the 15th richest guy in the US or something, maybe even the world, I don't know. But what actually comes through is just the passion for what he was doing, not the interest in becoming a billionaire, you know. And he's a smart guy from Oregon, you know, so it's a stable family background, and just had this idea and this passion for shoes.
Mm.
That's it. And he was a half-decent athlete, you know, he was a semi-decent runner. And he just took it upon himself just to go, right, I'm going to go and set up this kind of import network from Japan. And then, you know, I won't spoil the book, but, you know, 25, 30 years later, there's just a point in the book where you turn over the page and he says, and then I was worth 184 million.
Yeah.
And you're like,
love that.
And just that, as I said, it could be anything, you know, just it almost like the lifestyle that he's created for himself now, the success that he's had, it's just like a byproduct of how much he loved his job.
I'm
not saying I love my job as much as Phil Knight,
but it's so important.
He just had a passion for something,
yeah,
and he just went and did it, you know.
I feel like you'll always achieve a higher level of success if you love the thing that you do than just good at something that you don't really like.
I think
is average to you, you know?
A lot of successful people don't set out to become millionaires. They set out to do what they love doing, and then they throw themselves into it. They're committed, they love it, and it, you know, they might get rich or die trying, you know, but ultimately, if they're happy and connected, then
that's success, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say that. Yeah, so that was one. And I read, it's not related to this, but there's a book called Marching Powder.
Okay, I haven't heard of it.
Okay, so it's about a guy that smuggles and gets caught and goes to live in a Bolivian jail.
Okay.
And it's I've read it in about 10 hours. It's absolutely phenomenal. Honestly, it's brilliant.
Nice.
Yeah, but it's quite funny, actually.
I was a bit obsessed with the Narcos series on Netflix, so I'm sure I'll like that one.
It's a bit like that, yeah.
Okay, so second question. So this podcast is called Well and Wild, with the sense that to be well in life, you have to do some wild things and go a bit against the norm. So what's the wildest thing you've done?
I mean, I've given that Mankini story away, haven't I?
Are you going to choose that over running like multiple marathons in the desert?
I mean, that's sort of, I guess, how do you define wild?
Yeah.
You know? So to me...
Well, to you, I guess.
To me, I mean, I've done three skydives, you know. I've run through the streets of Milton Keynes in a Mankini with, you know, 15,000 runners around me. Yeah, I've run through the desert, you know, the Sahara Desert. I mean, as I tell you, I did an event last year that was pretty mad. It was in the UK. It's called what was it called? It was called the it's in Scotland. I can't remember what it's called now. But it's you start in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And you run a half marathon, but the half marathon starts at about 3 a.m. Run out of Edinburgh.
Why does
because
they want to torture you.
Because the length of the event is extreme.
Fine.
So start at 3 a.m, half marathon. So I had to stay in Edinburgh in this kind of, you know, I stayed in an easy jet hotel.
Ooh,
which didn't have any windows. It was like sleeping in a cabin.
Oh,
you know.
No.
Ran out from there, and then you basically pick your bike up.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get over the bridge into the Highlands, and you cycle 120 miles, you know, northwest into the country.
But I bet that was quite beautiful, though.
That was awesome. Yeah, it was absolutely awesome. I mean, some of the things that I've seen, obviously, you know, across those 43 marathon distances are pretty epic. But this cycling version was incredible, and the weather held. And then you finish the day by running a marathon up and over Ben Nevis.
Oh my God.
You know? So, you know, how is that wild?
I mean, that is wild.
Is it stupid?
Yes. I think it qualifies.
But I guess, you know, I'm fortunate to be fit enough to be able to get through those things.
Yeah.
So I'd say the wildest, stupidest, soppiest thing is running that Mankini, and running the marathon in Mankini. Yeah.
That's so funny. I love that tops all the other ones. Okay, and finally, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
Whoa. That's a really good question.
Or even like your mantra of like how, what you live by.
I'd probably say, you know, the best advice I've ever been given was, now if it doesn't feel right, it's not right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's been probably part and parcel of my decisions around things, which, you know, if I'm not connected to it, I'm not passionate about it, if I'm not, you know, if it doesn't sort of stir me or motivate me, then, you know, you don't have to force yourself to do it.
Yeah,
you know,
I think that's such good advice.
And I think maybe a lot of people feel safer, you know, I don't know, being a bit more obedient to what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not the antithesis of that obedience, because I still work in London, you know, I'm still commuting in from here. The trains are a shambles, you know, this morning. But, you know, I sort of ended up doing it kind of on my own terms almost. Mm-hmm. And that's because I've kind of done, well, if it feels good, you know, do it. And I've distanced myself from stuff that didn't. Maybe that came from my dad, actually.
Okay.
Maybe that came from my dad. I could probably give you a more profound answer if I thought about that for a while.
No, I think that's a really good one. And that's almost really the whole reason why I started doing this podcast, to be honest. So yeah. I think that's a good answer.
I'd say keep things simple as well. You know, I think a lot of people overcomplicate stuff and create stresses for themselves that, you know, we kind of self-invent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of people choose to be worried about stuff because they think they have to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think with what I've been through, I think maybe I just have less of a tolerance for it, and I perhaps think life's too short. You know,
puts life into perspective, I guess.
Well, I'd tell you what, there's a famous quote, isn't there? Like, at the end of the day, no one will remember the spreadsheet, you know, that you put together.
Yeah.
But you'll always remember that mountain that you ran over, so go and give it a go.
Yeah, that's very wise. Yeah. I've never heard that, but well, I like that.
I'm sure I've seen that.
Okay. Well, thanks, Tom, for coming on this podcast. Where can the listeners find you on, like, social media or...
So I'm on... What am I on?
I'm on Instagram.
I think it's TMJ Pope, I think. Is that right? It got changed. Yeah, is that right? How do I see that? Yeah, TMJ Pope. TMJ Pope.
Cool.
That's me.
But thanks so much for coming on. Yeah, it's so funny that you've come on and you're just the neighbour from downstairs, but you've got such an incredible story.
Well, yeah.
So thanks.
Thanks for having me. Hope that was all right.
Yeah, it was amazing. So that is the end of episode 11. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed it, please, please may you leave me a little review. You don't even need to write anything. You can literally just tap on the stars and it submits it in one. And it really helps me when I'm reaching out to new guests, because it just shows them that people are enjoying the stories and the guests that I've got on. So it will mean that I can keep bringing on amazing guests for you to listen to. So just, I would really, really appreciate it if you wouldn't mind doing that for me. Thank you so much for listening, and I will chat to you next week.